Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Margaret Gourlay about bone density testing and osteoporosis. I'm excited about this conversation.
Well, she's become quite famous with her new big article and research that sheds light on this, so I'm looking forward to talking with her. But first, we've got some good research that matters. Adam, we've got topics on mental activities for dementia and
Alzheimer's testing and things that people can do to maybe slow it down.
About prostate cancer and taking medicines.
To prevent prostate cancer, huh?
About antibiotics for sinus infections.
And we'll fess up about whether we ever take them.
And about medical errors.
Something that we never do, right?
Of course not. Of course not.
Let's jump right in, Christy, about this first research on Alzheimer's disease. And, you know, I think I've said on many times now that I got an increasing number of friends whose parents now have Alzheimer's. And this is an important research that looks at whether doing mental activities can help prevent a decline.
It's good. It's exciting research, I think, looking at group activities to stimulate thinking, conversation, memory. So these are our activities like discussing current events or show and tell with objects, baking, drawing, other activities to help people use their minds and studying whether it makes improvement or what happens over time to their mental abilities.
Yes, so these researchers put together what's called this systematic review, where they looked at multiple studies that had looked at this issue and put those studies together. And in total, there were over 700 patients studied. And what they found is that these stimulation sessions, what they called them, where they did these group activities, could last anywhere from a half hour to 1.5 hours, and it could happen once or up to 5 times a week.
And as they looked at all the studies together, they found that the people who were in these thinking stimulation groups performed about 1 or 2 points better than those who didn't participate on tests that range from 0 to 30 or 0 to 70, whereas most people decline over that period of time in 6 months or a year. The people who did those groups went up just a couple points.
Right. So it might seem that it was only a 2 to 8% improvement, that could actually be significant to a family member whose loved one has Alzheimer's and to the loved one who has Alzheimer's.
Absolutely. I think this is really hopeful.
There was no downside, was there?
Well, there was no downside, not a lot of risk to participating in this sort of thing. But the one disappointment thing was that as they looked at skills for daily living, the ability to dress and go to the bathroom and do some of the things for yourself that are so important, that they didn't see improvements in that. But it's hard to know if we've studied enough people and, you know, what it will show over time.
Yeah, good bottom line is I think we both like this research. And if we had a loved one with Alzheimer's, then we would want to be doing these sorts of activities with them because
Absolutely. We
would spend more time with them regardless. We like that.
Okay, let's do the next one. This is about prostate cancer and taking medicine to prevent it. Looking at, you know, something that's a common concern of a lot of our patients is prostate cancer. It affects 15 to 18% of men in this half of the world in North America, but only results in the death in 3%.
Well, and, you know, speaking as a man here, unfortunately, the reality is we've had less advances in prostate cancer in one respect in terms of that PSA test that we've been talking about is now nothing. We don't recommend that anymore for most men in terms of kind of trying to pick it up early. So the question is, perhaps there's research that we can prevent prostate cancer. What do we know about supplements and other sorts of interventions? And this was another systematic review that was in the Journal of the American Board of Family Medicine.
Yeah, so they looked at all the clinical trials that have looked into medication, drugs, or nutritional interventions to prevent prostate cancer to see, you know, based on the quality of the study and to see if there's anything that we should be recommending to men to help prevent prostate cancer.
And the only medication they came across that seemed to maybe have some promise was what's called these 5-alpha reductase inhibitors. Common names, what would people know about? These are things like... they're commonly used for benign prostatic hypertrophy, the drugs that we use to help prevent prostatic hypertrophy, to shrink like the prostate
Flomax
down.
Flomax.
Yes, Flomax would be a common name, or Cardura would be another common name. And the question is, do these medicines help patients prevent prostate cancer? And what they found is maybe, but we wouldn't necessarily recommend you take it outside of perhaps a clinical trial right now.
Yeah, and they thought that for patients who are of very high risk, there could be some benefit, but there's not enough evidence to say this is a good idea to just for all men to just take to reduce the chance of getting prostate cancer.
If you had a family member with prostate cancer, a father or a brother with an early age, this might be something you want to look into. And we'll put up some information if we can find it about maybe some places where there's some clinical trials of this looking at. What's our very next research that matters?
The next one is about antibiotics for sinus infections. So here's the question. Have you taken an antibiotic for your own sinus infection, Adam?
Well, I had a sinus infection 2 weeks ago, Christy. And I realized it was coming on early, and I didn't feel good, and I had that green and yellow stuff, yucky. And I did not take antibiotics, but I did do some saline nasal sprays to try to help irrigate my sinuses, and I got a little more sleep, and that seemed to help.
That's great. Great news.
Should I have?
Well, according to this research, I mean, this is published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And this is because, you know, it's really hard for doctors to tease out who needs antibiotics, who doesn't.
And people sometimes say, I really want some antibiotics. I've got green snot in my nose.
Right. And so this is, you know, diagnosing acute sinusitis, or not ongoing, but, you know, symptoms, severe cold-like symptoms, runny nose, pain around the eyes, et cetera, is a hard diagnosis, and people want antibiotics. So they looked at this.
And they gave antibiotics to, they took 166 adults, and they either got a 10-day treatment with amoxicillin, which is a common drug we'd recommend for sinusitis, or they got that placebo pill, and they came up with a rating scale called the Modified Sinonasal Outcome Test, or SNOT 16.
That was my favorite part of the whole study.
The SNOT 16. What's your score on the SNOT 16?
Do you have SNOT? Okay. So they looked at 166 adults,
and
they compared it. They found that over 10 days, 78% of the people who had antibiotics and 80% of the people on the placebo treated said they felt a lot better and no longer had symptoms. So everybody got better after 10 days, or at least 80%, the same amount got better after 10 days, whether you took antibiotics or not.
So initially in a sinus infection, we kind of knew this already. I don't think this is earth shattering for what we've talked about with our patients, Christy, that most sinus infections initially are viral. But if you've had the sinus infection for more than 10 days, where you're severely sick or high fever, you probably weren't in this group of people they tested, and that's a different group. But for most people, probably don't need them initially.
And so they are putting out some new guidelines that'll recommend treating only patients who have symptoms for more than 10 days, who keep getting worse, or who are severely sick with high fever and other symptoms. So hopefully that'll help us stop overprescribing.
Well, let's talk about our very last research that matters. And this was an article also in the Journal of the American Board of Family Medicine about errors in making primary care, and they do what do we do with this, and what do we learn from that? Because we all make errors. That's not earth-shattering news.
I know. I mean, we are humans doing the very best we can using the training that we've had, but sometimes we miss something. And so this was a study inviting a random sample of primary care doctors, so family physicians, general internists, general pediatricians practicing in Iowa, to have them describe an important error they made in diagnosis, and any sort of conclusions or recommendations they have for other doctors about it.
And what I found really interesting is they then classified the errors that the doctor said they had made into different groups. And those groups that I thought were the most interesting were the ones that they felt that might be learned from. There were three particular ones.
And one of them was, you know, just recommendations of always consider this diagnosis in patients who present with Y.
Right. So, that's the wisdom of our fathers and mothers here. And I remember the other night with a resident on call, Christy, who patient came in with pain and it was in their side, but they also had diabetes. And I said, always think about heart disease and mm-hmm. atypical pain with diabetes. That's that wisdom that we hopefully gather a little bit over time.
And the other recommendation was to look past the most obvious diagnosis, so to look beyond that.
So if there's something rare, you'll never diagnose a rare condition or something less obvious if you don't have it in your differential diagnosis.
Right. So not to sort of prematurely lock into the most obvious thing.
Right. And the very last one was to be aware that certain diseases that are typical can present with atypical, like an appendicitis that presents a little bit atypical.
Yep. So that hopefully gives us a little touch on the fact that we do make mistakes, but we're working to find ways to prevent those.
And then maybe ask your doctor, could this be a typical thing that's different, or could this be something rare? You can ask these questions and have your doctor talk about it with you.
Absolutely.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters. We've had a chance to talk about what we know and unfortunately don't know about preventing prostate cancer.
About group mental activities to help people with dementia.
About antibiotics that don't probably help most sinus infections.
And a little bit about making diagnostic errors in primary care.
So we'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk with Dr. Margaret Gourlay about frequency of bone density testing. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Adam and I are going to have a great chance to talk with Assistant Professor in the Department of Family Medicine at UNC, Dr. Margaret Gourlay, about frequency of bone density testing. And Dr. Gourlay, we're so proud of you and your recent article and just breakthroughs in understanding about bone density testing and osteoporosis. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
And Dr. Gourlay, you know, you've been thrust into the national scene because of this article in the New England Journal of Medicine that came out recently, but we have known that you've had an interest in osteoporosis and bone density for many years. Tell us how you got interested in this whole question of bone density screening and osteoporosis.
I got interested in the topic about 12 years ago when I was in training. I was at UC San Diego, University of California at San Diego, and was a second year resident. They were going to hold a hospital-wide symposium on hormone therapy, and they needed someone to do the talk on bone density and hormone therapy. I didn't know very much about the topic. I had read a little bit about it, but had to read a large amount for the symposium. And I was responsible for speaking for a half an hour to talk about what happens to women's bones after menopause, how do we use bone density testing to find women who should receive medicines so they don't have fractures later, and where does hormone therapy fit into all of that. So after doing all the reading, I gave my talk, the symposium went well, but later I came away realizing that there were a lot of missing things in the literature about how do we use bone density testing, can we find those women who do have thin bones, and what's the best way to go about that kind of testing to find them. And then 12 years later, here I am studying that as my main topic.
Wow, that's fascinating.
I think a lot of people out there are concerned about osteoporosis, concerned about breaking a hip and some of the bad things that happen. But give us a sense, how common is this in women who are post or after menopause?
This is a common condition. I try to call it a health condition rather than a disease because this is the way our bones age. In fact, a little over half of women who are aged 80 and older have osteoporosis, the thinnest level of bones. This is just what happens to our skeletons, and even for men at a later stage of life later. The importance of it doesn't have to do with a bone density at all. It's all about fracture. And as far as the numbers, there are about 40 million women who have either osteoporosis or thinner levels of bone density below the normal range who might be at risk. As far as the group that fractures, it's a smaller number. About 20% of women age 50 and older would have osteoporosis, and just a subset of that group would go on to fracture. But the reason why we're concerned about it is what happens after the worst kinds of fractures, hip and spine fractures. In the first year after a woman has a hip fracture, there's about 15% who will die. Spine fractures won't cause death as nearly as often, but they're very, very painful, and someone could be in a wheelchair. It could keep them from walking. So the numbers overall of women at risk are very large.
And what about when we think about the aging of the population? Because I can imagine 40 years ago, osteoporosis would have been there if you lived to a certain age or 100 years ago. But today, with an increasing number of people living into their 80s and soon to be 90s, this issue has to be one that's changing in front of our eyes.
It definitely is changing. In fact, when they did the population estimates back in the late 1990s versus about 2005, they found out that there is now less osteoporosis than there was back then. Right now, we have somewhere between 10 and 20% of all women age 50 and older who have osteoporosis, whereas back then it might have been around 30%. There were larger numbers. We still have to be careful because even though the percentage in the population might have gone down, the numbers of women are about the same because the population has grown. So overall, this is a lot of women, and the older the women get, the more they have to be concerned that their bones will be thinner, and
Wait,
we
so
need to.
It went down over time? Why is that?
Yes, the percent went down. When we're looking, this is a important thing about reading those numbers you see in the news or in studies. The percent, the number of women, you know, per 100 who have osteoporosis decreased from 1998. To 2005.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
But not maybe from 100 years ago.
That's correct. Yeah, okay. From 100 years ago, they weren't doing the bone density testing,
know.
So we...
Yes, okay.
But just to get it straight, the total number is going up because we have more people who are aging.
Correct. The total number, that's right, because the population has grown, our total number is staying pretty stable.
So let's talk about how to capture these women and how to identify which ones are at higher risk. Tell us about the question you were asking when you began the study.
Mm-hmm. The question that we were asking when we began the study was, how often should women over age 65 have a bone density test?
And right now the recommendation is?
Right now there really is no specific recommendation, which was why we...
why you asked that question.
That's an important question.
That's correct. We could have studied something that had been done before, but it was quite a problem from clinicians. And as someone who runs a little fracture clinic in the Family Medicine Center, I can't tell you how many times someone came up to me and said, when should I have the next test for this patient who has this bone density at this level? And I couldn't tell them based on any data. I didn't know any better than anyone else because the study had not been done.
Or I have a patient who's had a bone density 2 years ago and says they want another one, and I'm trying to figure out what's the right interval, how frequently should they have a bone density study.
And for our residents that you so kindly teach every year, they want so much to do the right thing for their patients, and we want to teach them properly, but really the answer has been, we don't know what seems reasonable for this patient.
Exactly. Dr. Page, you are the star teacher in our group, but when I think of all the teaching that we have to do, even on a casual basis when we're standing next to someone in clinic, we need those data, and this is something that was so basic. I'm very surprised that a study had not been done like this before, so it really was time.
So tell us then the question that you phrased, and so doing, also explain the difference between osteopenia and osteoporosis.
Very important. The question that we asked was, for a woman who is in the older range, over age 65, how often should we do this bone density test? And the your second...
The difference between osteopenia and osteoporosis, because your study is all relevant with that.
Thank you. The important difference is that osteoporosis is the thinnest category of bone density. the importance of osteoporosis is that we have medicines that we can treat osteoporosis with that will reduce the hip and the spine fractures, those fractures that are most important to bring down the number of in the population. Those will cause the most suffering. So we always want to focus on the fracture. We're studying or measuring the bone density in our clinics, and the patients will ask about their bone density number, but we always want to not lose sight of the fracture.
Osteopenia is not quite osteoporosis, but it's not normal.
Correct.
So thin bones, but not so thin that they're at high risk to break.
That's right. And in the three main categories are normal, which is very good, especially for these older women, osteopenia in between, and osteoporosis is lowest.
And you're trying to find the folks with osteoporosis because they're good treatments.
That's correct. We are not sure that the treatments work in people who have bone density that is above the range of osteoporosis unless they've already had a spine fracture.
And we don't know that treatment of osteopenia right now definitely prevents the fractures, or do we?
That's correct. We know that in the past, the bone density would increase by giving these medicines. However, the important outcome, the fracture, that decrease in the fractures was not demonstrated in the osteopenia group. So we have to be careful. We want to find the women who have the greatest risk and who will respond to the treatment.
Well, we are looking forward to hearing more about your study and how to identify these people at higher risk and find out how often we're supposed to be testing bone density. But we do need to take a short break, Dr. Gourlay. But when we come back, we'll continue talking about the frequency of bone density testing. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Margaret Gourlay about broken bones and bone density testing, about her recent article in the New England Journal of Medicine. And Dr. Gourlay, tell us what you found in your results, because this is really the first time that this type of research has been done.
That's correct. What we did in the study was to take nearly 5,000 women who were followed for up to 15 years in the study of osteoporotic fractures. And during the 15 years, the women had anywhere from 2 to 5 bone density tests. They were divided into 4 groups at the beginning of the study based on how thin their bones were, all the way from normal down to close to osteoporosis, but not quite there. What we found was a surprise to us. The top 2 groups who had the best bone density, that was the normal range and the slightly thin range, it took 15 years for about 10% of those women to transition to develop osteoporosis. It was much longer than we expected. For the women in the next lowest category, it took about 5 years for 10% of them to develop osteoporosis. With the women who had the thinnest bones when they started out in the study, it only took them about 1 year for 10% to develop osteoporosis. We knew that there would be a difference among the groups, but we didn't expect that much of a difference.
So depending on what that baseline, that very first bone density screening, that really told you a lot, or tells us a lot, about what might happen over the next period of time.
That's correct. We looked at some other things that might also predict what would happen over the next 10, 15 years, including their age, which was important. Older women had a little bit shorter of a time for 10% to develop osteoporosis. But some other things didn't seem to make as much of a difference. For example, current smoking, whether they were taking prednisone steroid medication, some other factors that might affect their bones that are in some risk tools that we use weren't as important as the bone density. So when your doctor is looking at the bone density result and trying to decide when should that next test be, the bone density test that you had today is the most important thing that will tell that person when the next test should be.
So let me ask a question about this 10% to develop it. I want to put this in some terms here. So if I'm a 65-year-old woman and I had a bone density that was normal, based on your study, between 15 to 17 years, something like that would be maybe when the next one could be done. to have that time, that 10%. So that means at 15 to 17 years, 1 out of 10 women might have developed it at that period of time, but 9 out of 10 would not have. Is that, am I interpreting that correctly or not?
That is correct. Some important things to remember is, first of all, these women did not have a hip or a spine fracture to begin with. At that point, we're not screening. They already had what we're trying to prevent. So we're starting out with a pretty healthy group who did not have osteoporosis, didn't have a hip or spine fracture. Those women did take a long time to develop the osteoporosis. As far as how long it would be between tests, it's easy to look at the time estimates and say that should be the screening interval. That's not what we meant for the study results at all. No doctor makes a decision like that. They don't look at a research study and cut out a little table from a paper and say, this is the way I'm going to decide my testing frequency. They're going to take that information about how long it takes for the disease to develop and make their own decision based on everything they know about that patient. It's very individualized.
So let's think about a couple individual scenarios. So going back to Adam's patient, 65. I'm 65 years old. I've never broken a bone. I don't have osteoporosis that we know about. And I get that screening test and it's normal. So what, as a physician now, being probably one of the most empowered and knowledgeable physicians in this field, would you recommend for my next screening? If I don't smoke and I'm not on steroids?
Very important. The first thing you want to do is consider the age. If the woman is in her 80s, then it's unlikely it's going to be a full 15 years. Mm-hmm. If, just for the sake of making an example, we'll say we take those time estimates in the paper literally and say it was a 15-year screening interval. You want to adjust down for age, no matter what else you do. Someone at 65 is different from someone who's 85 or older. The next thing you want to do is look at those special things about your patient. Every time it's different. I mentioned that prednisone medication didn't make a difference in our analysis of a large group of women. It makes a big difference on a patient on a one-to-one basis. If you have a woman who's very sick, for example, she has rheumatoid arthritis and she's taking prednisone for a long time, these results do not apply to her. Mm-hmm. She would need screening much more frequently. So it is individualized. If you have someone who's very, very healthy, and it doesn't happen as often as we wish it would, but if we do have patients who come in, for example, one doctor in our practice sent a patient to me with normal bone density who is in this age range, which is absolutely wonderful for her age, and she had no other osteoporosis risk factors. And the doctor very politely asked me to talk to her about not asking for tests so often. She didn't need tests every 2 or 3 years. And I told her, you have wonderful bone density. You are at low risk of fracture. And I totally agree with Dr. Johnson, who is, it's a different name, that you don't need a test again in 2 years.
But how often would you have a test?
How often? For that person who is actually right at age 65, it could have been about 10 or 15 years because there was nothing else going on. And at that point, we would know that only 10% of women would have developed osteoporosis and they still haven't had a fracture. So overall, that number that we had in our study was pretty conservative. It's when you have the extra qualifiers, extra risk factors kind of stacking up that you want to be more careful. 15 years is a long time and a lot can change.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, it could be for some women that they might say, well, in 15 years, only 10% would have developed it. What if it? What's the time frame for 20% to develop it? And that could be a much longer time frame. So they might say, I might wait 20 years. That could be an individual decision.
That's an important point. And in fact, we did look at the time estimates for the 20% threshold because we're quite aggressive in the U.S. about testing, not just bone density. Actually, with bone density testing, we don't have enough bone density testing going on. This test is kind of ignored compared to, say, mammograms and some others. But we like to test a lot in the U.S., and a 10% threshold was considered quite conservative from the U.S. clinicians who are on this author team. In Europe, 10% would be considered quite aggressive. positive, and they might be more interested in a 20% threshold. And that's totally appropriate. They're, depending on how much money is available to do the testing, the ethics in different settings, a 20% threshold could be totally fine. And that would be a longer time to the next osteoporosis test. We do want to make this a flexible decision. We don't want to lock anyone into a testing protocol.
Well, I like what Adam, what you're saying about individualizing it, as you're saying, Dr. Gourlay, not just to the patient and their conditions, but to the patient's values. There's some people who want to be tested often, and for that, there's a balance of what, you know, they want plus what makes sense in terms of guiding them about their risk. And then there are other people who really don't want to pay for or go through the hassle of having another test if it's really not going to give useful information.
Excellent point. And the patient is the most important decision maker. The doctor doesn't just hand them a screening interval. The discussion is always going to work that way. One thing for the patients to remember, though, is that as we all get older, we will change risk categories. That woman who started out in the normal range is eventually going to lose enough bone to be in the next category down. And then she'll cross the line into the category where the interval was every 5 years, not every 15 years, by the numbers we found. So she'll want to keep in mind that she wouldn't want to kind of disappear for 15 years or not go to her checkups very often, thinking that she doesn't need a test and is doing very well and nothing will change. Over time, we'll all lose bone density. We'll get into different risk categories. The decision will change over time.
Well, Dr. Gourlay, we're going to have to wrap up, but maybe you can just give our listeners two pieces of advice. One, if there is a website that they could go to for more information. The second thing is, what are the two or three things they can best do to preserve their bone health?
A great website to go to for a lot of information about osteoporosis and fractures is the National Osteoporosis Foundation website at www.nof.org.
They offer some. We'll put this on our website, okay?
Very good. As far as the best things you can do to preserve your bones and keep your bone health good, is go to your doctor, ask about testing, and ask for the right time to start testing for you. Our results only apply to women over age 65. Talk to your doctor before that about what you should be doing for your bones. And aside from that, the next best information is what mom told you all this time. Get that exercise. Eat calcium and vitamin D, foods that are rich in calcium and vitamin D, and be careful with your health. Your bones are something that can be healthy for a long time if you take those good conservative measures and stay healthy and active.
How'd you know my dad didn't tell me that?
But
dad does tell his children that. So.
That's
great.
Excellent.
That's wonderful advice, Dr. Gourlay. Thank you for taking time with us and for your work to really forward the field and help physicians take good care of our patients.
Oh, both of you are delightful.
Thank
and those
you
are
very
wonderful
much.
Questions.
Yeah.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Christy, we're going to talk about our listeners' health questions and concerns.
We have some good ones today, and we want to encourage those of you who would like for us to address a question on an upcoming show to send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. Now we've got a question about exposure to whooping cough.
About allergies and the range of possibilities.
About dry cough that could be from a medication.
Or even just chronic cough.
And about taking pills when you don't really know what it is.
When they show up in baggies.
Okay.
Well, let's jump right in here and jump right into the classroom where our very first question from a listener.
I'm a third grade teacher and one of my students just got diagnosed with whooping cough. They recommend that everyone in the class get treated with antibiotics whether they have symptoms or not. I'm 62 years old and I recently just got the tetanus pertussis vaccine. Do I need to get treated with antibiotics as well?
You know, you gave us a lot of good information here that you, it sounds like, were exposed to a person who had whooping cough and that you got the pertussis booster vaccine a couple of years ago. Good for you for staying on top of your vaccines.
And first off, let me just say, you have my blessings for being a third grade teacher, just in general. You know, thank you, thank you, thank you. I don't think we're paying you enough. And now you've got an entire class that's being exposed to what are the common things that kids get. And this is one of them cough and colds, but a case of whooping cough. We thought, was that eliminated? And it clearly it's not been eliminated.
No, but it is one of the pertussis is what we're talking about that causes the whooping cough, that sound of coughing. And when you're breathing in, that is especially true for the infants and young children who get pertussis. It's included in our vaccine series, but more people are not getting their vaccines or it may be wearing off. And so in this case, it's a decision about whether or not you as an adult is probably not as likely to get super sick from it as an infant would, should get antibiotics to prevent catching it.
And it's great that you got a booster because not all adults have gotten their boosters, and that makes your chances of coming down with it certainly less likely. And there's perhaps some disagreements or uncertainty about whether you should get antibiotics or not, because your risk is probably low, but it's not zero. And some groups would recommend that you go on and take a course of antibiotics, one of those mycin, like azithromycin or erythromycin.
So the same medicine, Z-Pak, that you've probably taken before. I think if you've got an allergy to those medicines, that would be something to influence a decision. I think, and if you have any exposure, if you have a grandchild or any infant in your life, then I would not think twice.
And if that child, maybe if that child who was diagnosed was there blowing their snot on you, and you had to help them with their cough right in your face, as a child did to me the other day in the airport, and the mother said, "Don't do that," and I was like, "Yes, it's a little late."
Well, some of these state rules are coming out to try to prevent this from spreading any further as we're doing our vaccine efforts to prevent it. So I think it's reasonable if they recommend that you take it, that you go ahead and follow through.
Let's listen to our very next house call with all of our daffodils and flowers starting to bloom.
My spring allergies are starting up. I'm not sure which medications to take this year. I've had mixed results in the past with Claritin or Claritin D. Which one is best?
Spring allergies. There has to be something that you know, spring allergies brings on symptoms for people, you know, because so many people start to get symptoms about now. And it's really, you know, I have a son that has allergies, and you watch his face swell and his eyes swell and his nose. This is really powerful.
Yeah, it's very bothersome to people, and especially something that's so beautiful and exciting in springtime to cause you such symptoms. There are a lot of different recommendations about allergies. And one thing I'd say that is really effective and something to consider with lower side effects if you have significant symptoms are the nose sprays, this nose steroids that can be long acting and that can be helpful to reduce your symptoms. But for some people, taking antihistamine by mouth every day is what it takes to be able to survive.
Most people probably who have significant allergies are undertreated rather than overtreated in our opinion. And so in preventing the allergies from getting worse is a lot easier than treating them once you have them. And so that nasal steroid that Christy talks about is a really good thing to start up if you have bad allergies about this time of year. And you might need more than two medicines even. If you have really bad eye problems, you might need an eye and a histamine drop. So a lot of times patients take several different types of medicines to get them through allergy season.
And for you, you're asking which one of these antihistamines is best. And you know, if Claritin worked for you in the past, that may work for you going forward. There are several now with Claritin and Zyrtec, I'm sorry I'm giving the trade names, but that are over-the-counter now that make them more accessible. And they can work by controlling symptoms for 24 hours, and they are typically less sedating than taking a Benadryl or something along that line.
Yeah, I usually get the generic Walmart, Kmart, CVS brand of these. And I usually don't get the ones that have the D in it, because that decongestant, while it may give you short-term relief, and some people do swear by it, it also can keep you up. It may raise your blood pressure. It does have some more side effects. So certainly talk with your doctor. Get the whole range of things that you can do to help you, both medications, over-the-counter, and prescription.
Good luck to you. Okay, let's take our next one.
I have an ongoing dry cough that's been going on for months. I thought it was sinuses and went through 2 rounds of antibiotics. I have allergies, but I don't have any other symptoms. I've been on enalapril during this time. My doctor said this could be the reason. How common is cough with enalapril? And do you have any other ideas?
So it's a good thought that your doctor said that the medication, an ACE inhibitor or enalapril, is one of those medications, can cause a cough. 5 to 20% of people who are on one of these types of medications develop a dry cough. Usually that happens when you start the medication or in the first 6 months of being on it, but it can also change as you change the dose potentially. And some people will change to a different medication called an ARB or something like Losartan that works in a very similar fashion to that one blood pressure medicine, but doesn't cause the cough as much.
And the thing that we really want you to work with is work with your provider, your doctor, because this has been going on for months. And so clearly you've gone through several things and you're now looking much broader. And whenever you have a chronic cough, you really should look much broader because there are possible medications. There are possible common things. You've treated some of them. And there's also other uncommon things that may be doing this. It could be you might be having reflux of acid silently at night and causing a cough and may not associate that cough with that reflux.
It could be, I mean, we'd want to know if you're a smoker. We'd want to know.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean,
we'd get that chest x-ray or some other CAT scan to make sure you don't have something more serious.
Yes. But, you know, in this case, if I were your doctor and I was concerned that this medicine could be the cause, bringing you off of it and changing it to a different one, you would notice a difference in the first, you know, 4 days to a week. And so,
if not, then
it's obviously not the
medicine. Start through that workup and you might even have to get some pulmonary function tests to be talked about another day.
Okay, and let's take our last question.
My daughter gave me a baggie with pills in it that I'm pretty sure is Vicodin. I have taken 2 of them when my arthritis is acting up, which helps. How do I find out for sure what medicine I'm taking?
Okay, Christy, my first question here is, what's the daughter thinking?
Yeah, it is a little concerning.
We know your daughter loves you. We know that you love your daughter. But what were we thinking giving a baggie full of pills to an elderly, someone who's a little bit older?
Yeah, that is a good question. And we don't have time to really grasp all the different issues that come up from this question. But
maybe it was a good thing. Maybe that it's their own pills that they're sharing. But again, don't share pills.
Yeah, it's not a great idea. And especially not to have a label on them, which is why they come in the pill bottles they do with the required label for safety. So, I mean, obviously by you asking this question, I think it implies that you're a little uncomfortable with it. And so bringing that, either just throwing them away altogether or bringing them into your doctor who can help you sort out with pill pictures what it could be.
But I'll tell you, Christy, most of my colleagues wouldn't really be able to know what the drug is, nor do I think they would actually spend the time. They would simply say, don't use this. I mean,
well, there are good apps on your phone that can help you discover what it is. But even if I knew
it
was,
to use it,
yeah, exactly.
To get an app, a pill finding app. You can do it. It may be important, particularly if you swallow a pill that you didn't know, or and then you have an extra one of those pills out there and trying to find out what someone's really taking. In this situation, it seems like we can work our way around it.
Yeah, I think I'd encourage you to throw them away.
Well, okay. That'll conclude the house calls for today, and that concludes the show for today. And we thank you for listening to us, and we hope you'll send us your own comments and questions.
We want you to email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes. Get our new iPhone or Android app.
And we'd like to thank the staff of WCHL, UNC Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Margaret Gourlay. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We will look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.